Thank you, John, and good morning, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here this morning. Y'all are a pretty bunch of drunks, I got to tell you. I have an idea there was a time when none of us would look quite like we do this morning, but this is a wonderful thing. I've been blessed with being at a few of these breakfasts that you folks tend to have along the East Coast, and I think they're a great idea, and really appreciate the opportunity to be involved in this one. John's been great on the phone to kind of mother hen me and that sort of thing, and Scott and Steve picked me up at the airport last night, and just great hosts, so thank all of you for letting me be here. And I got some bad news right off. We're going to need a lot of divine intervention over the next few minutes. That's the bad news. The good news is I found out when I'll stay close to you folks in these 12 steps that are the only program of recovery I know of that works for me. The divine intervention is pretty easy to get. And the first place we're going to need divine intervention is we got to have God's help to get me out of the way. I used to stand up to give an AA talk and say, if I can get me out of the way, I'm going to do this or that. Let me tell you something. If I could get me out of the way, I could have stayed in Louisville this weekend. By the grace of God, my sobriety date's April 9th of 1981. And I'm not a bit more capable this morning of getting me out of the way than I was in April 1981. It's just way too big a job for me. Second place I'm thinking of offhand that we're going to need divine intervention is I'm going to try to follow directions. And I've got a long and sad history with the directions. And all you folks that have been sober a long time will be shocked at this, but my case is different. Always has been, you know. And this little fella inside me, and he and I are the world's greatest experts on everything. Now, whether we know anything about it or not is beside the point. We know it all, and we are sophisticated. We are worldly. You don't pull the wool over our eyes. And we know who makes the directions. Square Johns. Just button-down conservative Square Johns are always in charge of making the directions. And we know the purpose of the directions. It's to manipulate idiots into doing things. So they overstate everything, you know, trying to manipulate the idiots. And in special circumstances like mine, it's necessary to sort of extrapolate in order to figure out what the directions might really mean. And I've been very blessed in that regard. It doesn't require any effort. In fact, I'm normally not aware of it. It just happens automatically. But I assure you, just for instance, if I see some directions that say do not exceed 6 in 24 hours. Without divine intervention, my brain will actually register that as really meaning something like do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. So we're going to need the divine intervention there, and the directions I hope to follow for a little while this morning are the ones we hear all the time. Talk a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And a set of directions that we don't talk as much about. The book tells me that our personal stories tell in our own language and from our own point of view how we've been able to form a relationship with our Creator. And I really hope that my story carries that, because when I was first exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was allergic to the God thing. I'm not talking about skeptical or even closed to it. I was allergic. When you guys would mention it, the little hairs would stand up on the back of my neck and my intelligence would be insulted. And as far as this higher power deal, you weren't fooling me. I knew what you were doing. You were trying to backdoor me on the God crap. I think that made me even madder. So that would run me out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of the ones that's been so blessed because I was allowed to live long enough to get run back in here enough by alcohol because I didn't have anywhere else to go. Until finally that miracle happened and I was able to take the hand that you guys had been holding out to me for a long time. And I was able to let you lead me through these 12 steps. And those 12 steps led me to a loving God that I didn't even know was there for me. And that, folks, is the only reason that I'm standing down here in front of you great folks this morning instead of having been rotting in a pauper's grave for over 27 years. So I really hope that my message carries that. Grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky, and probably the But probably the most important thing I can tell you about my childhood is that it wasn't a thing like I thought it was. My capacity for self-delusion is amazing, and it's still totally intact. Without divine intervention, I've got the full capacity for it that I always had. And I was 37 when I got sober, and up until that time, I would tell you the saga. It wasn't just a story. It was a saga about my early struggles and subsequent rise to power. And of course, it was all about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reached in life. And I believed that crap so sincerely, I'd have you and me both crying before I was halfway done with it. And I was over a week when I realized it is a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. We weren't anywhere close to poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and most of the things that we wanted. And those staggering heights were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. My alcoholism is many, many things. And in fact, I genuinely do believe that there's no story of Don Major other than the story of alcoholism and the recovery from it. I believe that. Every fiber of my being on every level is alcoholic. And my alcoholism is so many different things. There's so many different parts. But one thing that it clearly is a disease of superlatives. And what I mean by that is that without divine intervention, I won't even think in terms of things like good and bad. And ordinary will never cross my mind. I'll think in terms of best, worst, just the absolute extremes of everything. Now, that's caused me a lot of trouble, a lot of different ways. One way has caused me trouble. I really believe that there's a part of me that more than anything has always really wanted to be the best, if it wasn't too much trouble. Of course, being the best has always been too much trouble. And where the rub comes in is that without divine intervention, when it's clear that being best is too much trouble, my second choice is not second best. It's worst. I just want to stay as far away from the middle as I possibly can. And the truth is that both drunk and sober, I've been a whole lot more ordinary garden variety than my ego's ever been able to stand. What was really going on the first 12 or 13 years of my life was selfishness and self-centeredness. The book says that's the root of our troubles. And what that means to me is that the first thing wrong with me, the thing that's wrong with me before any of the rest of it, before the physical allergy to alcohol ever became a factor, before the mental obsession ever set in, before any of the physical, emotional, spiritual, mental problems that come with alcoholism, the first thing wrong with me is that I've got a disorder of my ego. And I've had it all my life. And on account of that disorder of my ego, I've always been so obsessed with myself. I'm so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people. I'm so obsessed with how I feel. In fact, the last several years, I've tended to boil my alcoholism down, or the very base of my alcoholism, down to one sentence. And I believe it's true. Without divine intervention, I will always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the universe. Now, without divine intervention, I can give lip service to things being more important than how I feel. And I may be able to act for a little while like something might be more important than how I feel. But without divine intervention, that's all a smokescreen. When the chips get down, how I feel is going to be the most important thing in the universe to me. That obsession with myself and all that self-obsession. And by the way, I still just absolutely love to obsess on self. In fact, after 27 years, I'm still doing research on trying to find a way to treat alcoholism by obsessing on self. It's difficult because alcoholism is a disease of self-centeredness, but my God, I love to obsess on myself. Nothing else makes me so exquisitely miserable, and sometimes I can dress it up in psychological clothing and try to obsess on myself for a while, and I can dress it up in spiritual clothing and obsess on myself for a while, but it never works. It's like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. I can't treat an illness successfully that is self-obsession by obsessing on myself. But what's happened all my life is that all that obsession with myself has created so much pain and emptiness down inside me that I've never been able to stand the way I feel inside without either running as hard as I can and or stuffing something in there to try to make me feel good enough that I can stand it. And that's really the story of the first 12 or 13 years of my life, is a little kid trying to stay a half a step ahead of a screaming fit, keeping all the bells ringing, the lights flashing, the smoke coming out, trying to keep you from seeing what I was so that I wouldn't have to look at it and be swallowed up by that emptiness in my own belly. And there were many things flow from that ego disorder. One thing is, I think that's where the trouble with God came from, with the personal God. I normally did not book myself as being an atheist. I was only an atheist if it made a good argument at the moment. I was usually okay with some sort of intellectual theory about a creative force. But when it got down to what my religious friends today call a personal God, a God that is more important in the actual conducting and unfolding of every minute, of every hour, of every day of my life, more important than anything, including my brain. My ego vetoed that and said, we can't even consider that. We cannot consider that there's anything more important than our brain as far as running our life on a minute-to-minute basis. So I was never able to consider the possibility of a personal God. Another result of it is that I don't believe I had any teachability or humility whatsoever until I got sober. And the reason I don't believe I had any is I've never been able to remember a single time that I voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work. And that still sounds pretty good this morning, doesn't it? Why in the world should we do something voluntarily about our life if we don't understand it or we don't agree with it or we don't think it'll work? When I get honest, it's simple. I've got a talking Elvis. My alcoholism has been running its mouth at me all my life, and I've always had an old crazy picture show rolling in the back of my head. And I got to tell you, 27 years a day at a time without a drink, a few thousand AA meetings and several trips through the steps and many, many days trying with varying results to live on steps 10, 11, and 12, that hadn't gone away. My recovery has not been that my alcoholism stopped talking to me, and it hasn't been that the old crazy picture show went away. What my recovery has been is that most of the time, I can recognize that's not reality and I don't have to obey it. And by the way, let me just make a kind of a parenthetical statement here. A lot of times I think people walk away from my talk saying that, or feeling like that I'm saying stuff your feelings, what you feel doesn't matter. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I found these 12 steps to be the most effective device for identifying my feelings and looking them in the eye that I've ever found in my life. What I am saying is that building shrines to my feelings didn't work too well. What I am saying is there's just this outside possibility that what I feel is not the most important thing in the universe. When I look back on all the wreckage and the damage of my alcoholism, what I thought, felt, and believed never hurt a thing, guys. It was what I did. And when I look back over my recovery, thank God that my recovery doesn't have to be judged on what I think, feel, and believe on any given day, because it still gets pretty doggone squirrely up there sometimes. It's only what I do. So that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying stuff our feelings. I'm saying that in my case, you see, before I got sober, and today without divine intervention, here's how I am on the natural. When I have a feeling, all of my behavior will automatically fall in behind my feeling, and I'll go to work on you to get your behavior to fall in behind my feeling. You know, and just maybe that's not the way it needs to be for me. Maybe I need to go ahead and do those right actions even though I don't feel like doing it, and that's been a tough lesson. And I hope this is not as bad a news to a lot of you all as it has been to me, but in 27 and a half years, I have really, really done a lot of work on trying to get me fixed inside so I'd feel like doing right. Because, you see, without divine intervention, I think that's the way things are supposed to work. I think the difference between good people and me is they feel like doing right. And if we can just get me fixed so I feel like doing right, why, I'd be good people, too. And the last 27 and a half years, I have prayed until I was blue in the face. to try to get God to fix me inside so as I'd feel like doing right so I could do right. And I have worried two or three sponsors to distinction talking about what kind of internal adjustments we needed to make to my spiritual condition so as I'd feel like doing right and could do right. I've done enough inventories that they'd probably stack up a foot and a half from the floor if we had them stacked up here. And after I got making a little money in sobriety, I spent quite a bit on outside counseling trying to get me fixed inside so I'd feel like doing right so I could do right. And here's the really bad news. Not one time in 27 and a half years has anything made me feel like doing right except going on and doing right when I don't feel like it. And that is just more maturity than I can almost stand. But that's the way it's been with me. But at any rate, what happens? I'm going back to that ego disorder and that obsession with myself. It keeps me, when I put that final veto in the universe in my brain, that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it and I agree with it and I think it'll work, here's the problem. My alcoholism in talking to me, it's not trying to kill me because it doesn't care whether I live or die. My alcoholism doesn't care whether you live or die. My alcoholism is the perfect sociopath. It's only got one reason for existing, that's try to get itself a drink. And it'll tell me something that'll kill you, me, or both of us. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another without ever dropping a stitch. It doesn't care. It'll just sling it all up against the wall and hope some of it will stick. And that's about the scariest thing about my alcoholism is my alcoholism just doesn't even care whether I live or die. It doesn't care. All it wants is a drink. And if 100% of the time I could say, that's just my alcoholism talking to me, I'm going to go to a meeting or return this telephone call or write this paper that I need to write or I'm going to wash the dishes or whatever, it'd be fine. But, you know, I said my alcoholism is so many different things. One thing that it clearly is a disorder of my perception, which literally translates, I don't always see things right. I don't always hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. So when I put that final veto in the universe in my little old brain, and by the way, my brain talking to me and my alcoholism talking to me without divine intervention are one and the same thing because I have an alcoholic brain. And when I put that final veto there, what I've done, I've put myself under death sentence. Because I wind up believing one of those deadly lies and I'll pick up that drink and I know what'll happen to me based on where I was when I last checked on it and what I know about this thing. I'll die a mad dog dead. another little thing that ego disorder has done for me is I've always been an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And what I mean by that is I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something or somebody and at the same instant, knowing I wasn't nearly good enough for that same thing or that same somebody. I've always known that I could do anything. And at the same time, I've always known that I couldn't really do anything. And, you know, I don't think it's bothered me to wander around this earth all these years with those totally diametrically opposed thoughts and feelings bouncing around. The weird thing is, the thing that I can't be without divine intervention is just okay. I can't be okay for anything or anybody. I can feel too good for it. I can feel too bad for it. I can feel both those at the same time. But without the divine intervention, I can't feel just okay for anything the face of this earth. And that's the mess that I brought to the first drunk when I was 12 or 13. That first night I got in a lot of trouble and I puked and I blacked out and I passed out. I woke up next morning and had a terrible hangover, and I swore all those Baptists around there were right, and I would never, ever do it again. And I couldn't have been more sincere. And actually, it was fairly effective because it was nearly a week until I got drunk the second time. And the way things were going to go for the next 25 years, that was a near miracle to go nearly a week without getting drunk. And, of course, I got drunk the second time for the same reason I got drunk the 2,000th time, because of the magic that had happened. Now, at the time that it happened, I didn't know that it was magic. I didn't figure that out until after I got sober a quarter of a century later. All I knew at the time was that for a few minutes on my way to puking and so on, I had passed through a right pleasant neighborhood. But looking back on it, of course it was magic. And the reason it was magic was because when I got enough of that stuff in me for the first time, it did something about that pain and that emptiness inside me. it made me feel good enough inside that I could stand it without running or without trying to stuff anything else in there. And remember, how I feel is the most important thing in the universe. So my powerlessness over alcohol and the things like it is a no-brainer. For the next 25 years, when I wanted or needed to change the way I felt, the real bottom line was it didn't matter what it cost. And it didn't matter who it cost. Because how I feel is the most important thing. And that's the only thing I'd ever found that made me feel good enough inside that I could stand the way I felt. I'm not going to give you all much of a drunkologue. I'll tell you that for the 25 years after that first drunk, alcohol dominated everything in my life. Not just alcoholism, alcohol did. We all have different kinds of drinking stories, and we all have to guard against bragging not only about how good we are, about how bad we were. But the real truth is that I don't remember ever apologizing for my drinking. I don't remember ever hiding my drinking. I don't remember ever one time in my life telling myself or anybody else that I was just going to have a couple of drinks. I never wanted a couple of drinks. A couple of drinks never did anything to me except make me need something to drink real bad. I'm confident I went to bed legally drunk at least 80% of the nights in that 25 years. I had no idea I was going to bed drunk that often, because the only definition of drunk I ever had was whether or not I blacked out. If I remembered everything, case closed, end of discussion, I wasn't drunk. Now that Kentucky's got that legal limit down to .08, I probably woke up drunk 80% of the mornings. By the time I was in my mid-teens, I'd figured out that if anybody, I'm not talking about just girlfriends, parents, teachers, close friends, I'm talking about the paper boy if I had enough to do with him. If anybody stayed close enough to me long enough, they'd wind up blowing the whistle on my drinking. And I'd figured that out by the time I was in my mid-teens. And consequently, I'm not proud of this. I've had to do an awful lot of eighth and ninth step work on account of it. For the last 20 years, roughly, I drank. I don't even think I had people in my life. I think I had positions. And whatever your position was in my life, I probably had your replacement interviewed at any given time, because I knew the time was going to come when you blew the whistle on my drinking. And if I couldn't change your mind, and I got really good at that, but if I couldn't change your mind, you had to go. It didn't make any difference how much another part of me loved you or cared about you. You were interfering with the most important thing in my world, and that was how I felt, and the only thing that made me feel the way I wanted to feel. So you had to go. School was really easy for me. When I was 16 years old and a junior in high school, on one hand, needed a little drink of water there. On one hand, the egomania was still telling me that that tobacco farm couldn't hold something hot as I was. But a little dose of realism knew that everything was just about to come tumbling down big time on account of the drinking. So I walked out of a tobacco patch and got on a Greyhound bus and took it 200 miles up to the big city of Louisville in Kentucky. I kicked around for two or three days. School had always been really easy for me, and I kicked around two or three days, and I wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville, and they gave me a bunch of tests over a few days and let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. And my reaction to that was to stay so drunk the first semester that I lost all concept of day and night. It was just a matter of passing out and coming to, and, of course, I blew the scholarship. And so for the next 7.5 years, I worked full-time, drank full-time, went to school full-time, and somehow finished undergraduate and law school. And I've got no idea how that happened. When I look back on that 8 years, I don't have a handful of concrete memories of the whole 8 years. It all just feels like a whirling gray mass of alcoholic insanity. In the spring of 1968, I graduated from law school, and my daughter Dana, who's 40 now, was born. And I started practicing law in downtown Louisville, and I practiced for about 10 years with a pretty good little bit of success. Not nearly as much as I used to think I'd had, by the way, but it's funny how our stories change after we've been sober a while, and they really do. It isn't that we're trying to be dishonest. We just get a different focus on things. If I lived to be sober as long as our friend Joe back there, I may find out I was a total failure. I don't know. But I've always been a criminal defense lawyer, and I've always had a knack for getting involved in cases that hadn't money and publicity in them, and that's what I would stick in your face when you suggested that there was something wrong with somebody who lived as insanely as I did. And the insanity escalated for me during that 10 years, from the time I got out of law school until 1978. I'm sure one reason it escalated was because I had some money to escalate it with. I began to use a lot of things other than the booze during that 10 years, but just exactly like they were with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. When you look at their stories, those other things were sideshows to the booze. The booze was the big tent. Those other things were things to change the effect of the booze, increase the effect, decrease the effect, help me try to function on the hangovers. But the booze was the big tent. February 10th of 1978, I'd been practicing law about 10 years, and I was hanging on to the material things by my fingernails, but I still had them. I was remarried at that time to my daughter's mother, and over the years, by the way, I've decided nobody does that but us. I've decided that the fact that I was remarried to the same woman establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. I believe that if a normie even considered jumping right back in a frying pan they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum getting in to protect themselves. And we do it routinely, drunk and sober. You know, old Bob and Sue are divorced, but they're dating. They'll probably get back together. And the bizarre thing is it works for us sometimes. It's not even bad. It's just real different from ordinary people. And you know, please feel free to ignore that. That's my one sociological comment of the morning. It's not in the big book, but that's been my observation. I was remarried to my daughter's mama, and, of course, I was with a woman that was not my daughter's mama. And I got full of scotch, cocaine, quaaludes, speed, and vodka, and drove a Corvette off the road about 130 miles an hour. I did an awful lot of bad things. My body broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg, had to do a bypass in the upper leg, take out a vein, graft it in to replace the artery, and separated my pelvis and pulled my plumbing in two, so I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had a super pubic catheter, they call it, just a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen, pop that sucker into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. And I was in hospital more than 6 months that first year and had a half dozen major surgeries. The doctors told me early on that I would never walk again without braces on both legs and maybe one or two canes. And they told me that they were positive that we'd never find a surgeon that would even attempt to put my plumbing back together so I would ever pee again. Just for the record, and purely by the grace of God, because it was not me following directions, we know. I've been sober 27 and a half years, and I haven't owned a brace or a cane for over 28 and a half years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did put my plumbing back together and restore my urinary function. But I didn't know that was going to happen. And my reaction to that, the accident had happened close to Tennessee line, so they had rushed me to Vanderbilt, and they kept me down there in intensive care and surgery for 6 weeks or so, but they didn't know who I was down there. They didn't treat me with nearly the appropriate deference, so as soon as I was able, against medical advice, to get myself moved back to Louisville with entourage, I did. And I laid in the Louisville hospitals for months, and some of the guys that my friends had visited me are sober in the program now. Every single day, my friends would come in and bring me booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me. And I would lay in that hospital bed with that prognosis, not walking without the braces and the canes and never peeing. I would lay in that hospital bed with that prognosis and say really intelligent things. I would say things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough. But it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. And then I'd explain to him that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he's not prepared to do the time. And just because it hit a little bump in the road, they weren't going to hear me whining. Give me another drink and let's go on with it. And that's real insanity. And that's real powerlessness. And that is truly letting how I feel now be the most important thing in the universe. More important than my child. More important than my family. More important than my profession. More important than my health. More important than whether I lived or died. Letting how I feel be the most important thing in the universe. Of course, my daughter's mama divorced me again right away, and I wound up married to the young lady during that period who had been with me when I had the wreck. She was hurt, but not nearly as badly as I was. She had on a seatbelt, for God's sake. And Didn't go broke right away. A little law firm of a few lawyers had built up around this other guy and myself, so some money kept coming in for a little while. And about a year after that wreck, I still had the tube in my belly and my catheter bag, my braces, my crutches, and I made my first trip to the asylum. And I don't use that word to be cute. Bill Wilson uses that word in the big book, and my mama used that word. A lot of places I was in were called psychiatric hospitals. A lot of them were called treatment centers. But I made it to that first one, and by that time, the phenomenon of craving that the doctor's opinion talks about, and there's nothing complicated about the phenomenon of craving. All it is the physical addiction to ethyl alcohol. And we're told that every alcoholic either has it when they start drinking or they'll develop it and that it progresses. And I'd always had it, but for all those years, the fear that if I didn't jump out of that bed and throw a toothbrush in my mouth and usually throw up and try to put on the right clothes and show up where I was supposed to, that you'd see what I was and I'd have to face what I was, that fear for all those years was just a little bit greater than that need to just drink around the clock. Nobody ever had to tell me that drinking in the morning would cure a hangover. I was born knowing that somewhere in the marrow of my bones. But that terror, which, by the way, I never had any ambition. My motivation was terror that if I didn't keep trying to make the right noise and show up at the right place, that you would see and I'd have to face what I was and what I wasn't. But at any rate, that craving progressed. And by the time I made it to that first asylum, it had reached a point where once I started drinking, I had just pretty well physically lost the ability to stop. Something had to intervene and get me prized loose from alcohol. And when something did that, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to do something like sit up in a chair. Well, they got me through the 3 or 4 days in that place, and they sat me up in a chair and for some reason had an AA meeting, thought that might be a good thing for me. And somebody got up and read steps. They got step 3, made a decision, turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him, and I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And then I hobbled on over the telephone to call somebody to get me away from those religious fanatics before they polluted my pristine intellect. Well, that was sometime around the first year of 79. And I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81. And I really don't remember much of what happened in that. But some things I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a Needle Street junkie, and I'm real grateful for that. It was necessary, I believe, for that for me to live, because that brought enough pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I had founded, and I proved that I wasn't going to make the decision at its bottom. And don't kid yourself. Bottom is not an accident. It doesn't even really have a huge component of grace. Bottom is a decision over which we as alcoholics have got control. And until we do bottom, we're never going to hit bottom. We're not apt to be walking across the street one morning at 10 o'clock with a slight hangover, and all of a sudden it hits us, "My God, I'm at bottom." Alcoholism is an elevator, and it's hardwired to the basement. That's where it's going. But anytime we'll take our hand and reach our finger out and punch the button, we can stop it on any floor that we want to. Now, the kicker in that is that the people in AA can't push the button for us, and God apparently won't. The bad news is we have to do the first mature thing we have ever done in our life, and that's push the button. But at any rate, I wasn't going to make that decision at its bottom as long as I had a Timex watch. I certainly wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. And right after the boys kicked me out of the law firm, the state of Kentucky jerked my law license. My new wife had to leave me on account of my insanity, and during that period she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident. I last laid eyes on Dana, who was my only child for over 20 years. I've got a 19-year-old son now, but I last laid eyes on Dana in January of 1980, and I didn't see or talk to her again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my portion of the office building that we'd built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things like that. The mortgage companies took the homes the ex-wives were in, and it was just all gone. And for about a year up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address on what I called the street and an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. And how that happened, but that it was so conscious, is that a good half of those 18 places that I'm calling asylums had treatment programs based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have anywhere to go, if I was able between trips to the asylum, I would frequently go to a World of AA meetings between trips to the asylum. I had a head full of information about recovery. In fact, one of my frequent and sincere prayers right today, and this is not a joke, is that I don't ever know as much about AA as I did before I could get sober. And what would happen during that year is that one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain, my alcoholism, one and the same, would go, yeah, I know, but you don't understand how special our circumstances are. You don't understand how intelligent we are. My God, and what a broad stage we've played on. And our tentacles have just touched so many. And you don't understand that we see things more clearly than ordinary people. And my God, we feel them so much more acutely that we are wounded by our own understanding. Soul just too big for the body. And of course, I know I'm an alcoholic, for that matter, a dope fiend too. But what you simpletons don't understand is that those are just symptoms or results of the real problem. My real problem is so much more complex than that, and I was apt to get teary-eyed, so grateful you simple-minded folks could obsess on the little symptoms and babble about your myth of a higher power and go to your little group therapy sessions you call meetings and somehow expect this terrible and magnificent complexity to go away. But alas, I was doomed by my own magnificence. And here's the nightmare. The very next minute, one of you would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life, and my brain would go, yeah, I know. I know it works for you, but you don't know how bad I am. You don't know about the parts of me that are just missing and always have been. You don't know that I've never been able to love anything or anybody, not even myself. And you don't know that I've never been able to be consistently responsible about one single thing in my miserable life. That anything in my life that looks like it was even okay, much less good, is some kind of pack of lies and a house of cards. And you guys have got people and things left to get sober with and to get sober for. You don't know how bad I've been. This deal won't work for me. If for some reason I were to be, if some miracle I was able to stay sober for a couple of months, it would just be to be blown into by a sawed-off shotgun, or at best spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary. So it won't work for me because I'm so terrible. Very next minute, it's back telling me it won't work for me because I'm so great, and I guess I'm believing it both times. Fall of 1980, I washed up on the doorstep of Asylum Number 17 in Nashville, Tennessee. They let me in. They told me later because they didn't think I'd live a week if they left me on the street. I had, of course, no home, no car, no clothes, teeth rotting out of my head. I stayed in there about a month, time to boot me out. I had no place to go, and I had a roommate there that was a young fellow, and his family lived in Nashville, Tennessee, and they felt sorry for me and said, Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days, and let's try to figure out what to do with you. So I went and lived with them for a year. And by the way, I've, in the last two or three months, I've had an opportunity to see those great folks three times and sit down and help them a little bit with something just wonderful. And, you know, they're not in AA. No, don't really need to be. And it's peculiar. We stay in getting sober for a little while. We sort of, at least privately, believe alcoholics have got a monopoly on spirituality, you know. And my wife's not an alcoholic. Sometimes I have to just catch myself saying, my God, honey, what do you know about spirituality? You're not even an alcoholic. And some of you may not like this, but I'm going to tell you what I believe to be the truth. I believe the truth is that in 1935, God took pity on a bunch of spiritual retardees and put the wonderful spirituality that the world has been enjoying for millennia into such a simple package that even we could grab hold of a little corner of it. But anyway, those wonderful people took me in, and for the first 6 months, from the time I got out of that asylum in the fall of 80 until I got sober in April of 81, I didn't stay straight, but I got better. And I believe I had to get better before I could get sober, and that's not in the big book either, but I was in bad shape. Two or three months after I was sober, I mean, when I was in my long-term sobriety, two or three months, night after night, really in my 27 and a half years, when I was sober, for two or three months. Night after night, I would go from the meeting at the 202 Club, a clubhouse there in Nashville where I went to a lot of meetings, with a bunch of people up to the Shoney's restaurant, and I would sit there with knife and fork under the table trying to mimic what my friends were doing, using that knife and fork to eat food. I had just lost the capacity to do that. It wasn't a matter of forgetting. I don't know what it was. And I guess I was just embarrassed to say to one of my friends, excuse me, I seem to have lost the ability to use eating utensils, but you help me here. So I was in bad shape. But during that 6 months before I got sober, I did get better. I went to a world of AA meetings, most of them at that 202 club in Nashville. Got to where I could go as long as 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped, and that was a world record for me in or out of the asylum. I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum. And how I really know I got better is that during that 6 months, they only put me back in a rubber room one time. At the rate I'd been going, twice a year in the asylum looked like the picture of mental health. And in late March of 81, I got on my most recent drunk. It was another one of my pop-off vodka / Listerine drunks. And I have truly drunk a barrel of both those things. And this is not a joke either. I've got better memories of the Listerine. I can stand to smell Listerine, Dave, but I can't stand to smell that old pop-off. But on this most recent drunk, I was drinking and taking everything I could find. And by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville. I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks, and the loving God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. Now, for the first few weeks that I was sober, I had no idea that I had any gifts, and had no idea that there was any such thing as a loving God. And this is really important to me. Coming off that last drunk didn't feel any different than the 200 before it. I didn't change my mind about a thing. I didn't feel any differently about one thing. I didn't have a bit less feelings of being too special for this program to work for my problems. I didn't have a bit less of the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. The biggest gift that my loving God had given me, and I had no idea that I had it, was the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to do some things that were suggested, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they would work, and I certainly didn't want to do them. 3 or 4 days after that most recent drink, when I was able to stumble, I stumbled back to the door of that 202 clubhouse in Nashville. And I didn't think they would let me in, and they really should not have let me in. I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out of the clubhouse. They had caught me shooting dope in the men's room. They had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through that clubhouse, and a big old boy about 6'6", by the name of Joe Wald, Joe's dead now, bless his heart, walked up and looked down at me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." And I thought he was giving me a compliment. My knee-jerk reaction was, well, thank God these people finally figured out who they're dealing with. But Joe went on. And he said, "And you know, that's a real shame, Don, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all the time." And that felt like an icy hand closing over something inside me, and it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to that door, and they did let me in. I remember exactly what was said and who said it. They said, "Yeah, Don, come on in. You're keeping us sober." And I said, "Well, y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live." And they said, "Sure, don't drink, don't take dope, go to meetings." By the grace of God, the first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. And this is very important to me. I clearly remember that during those 60 days, it was obvious these fool meetings were doing little, if any, good. It was still clear that you all were religious fanatics. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our butt out of the sand, our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, big car, good-looking woman, be somebody, for heaven's sake. But I'd been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had of being able to turn around to my brain and say, "Yeah, I know, partner, but you and I have nearly killed one another. And we don't have anything left to do except keep going to those dumb old meetings, even though they can't possibly solve our unique problems." And I had it all backwards. I thought in order for AA to work, it had to feel like it was working. I thought I had to believe it was working. Turned out that didn't have a thing in the world to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting and let my old sick brain and soul get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind the raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I needed to read the big book. And I said, "I've read it several times." And they said, "We know. You've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying. They said, you've got it in your head, this book is some sort of philosophy book. There's something in there you can learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety. He said, partner, get that crap out of your head. He said, in the first place, don't buy this crap that recovery is a learning process. He said, you've got to learn about that much. And they said, Don, in your case, you have had enough information about Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery for over 2 years to stay sober a day at a time the rest of your life without ever learning one single new piece of information about recovery. What's killing you is not what you know and don't know, dummy, it's what you're doing and not doing. In fact, they said, this big book is not the solution to your alcoholism. And I said, now, wait a minute. You've been telling me for 2.5 years that this big book is the solution to my alcoholism. They said, no, we haven't. We've been telling you that the action described in that book is the solution to your alcoholism. They said, what recovery is, instead of a learning process, is a doing process. What this book is, instead of a philosophy book, is a simple instruction manual for your actions. And they said, if you want to live, you better come back to this book like a little child. And start at the front cover and go through it line for line, reading only the black part, not interpreting, memorizing, arguing with, or distinguishing a single thing, and not looking for anything to learn, but looking for what it says do. And if you want to live, when you get to the instructions on what you need to do, you had better do that. That was when they explained to me that the steps are the only program of recovery. Nothing else in this book is called a program of recovery. Further, they are the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was explained to me. And be a member of this fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking. Thank God there's no other requirement. But if I try to latch on to this fellowship without doing the program of recovery, without the steps, I might stay dry a week, and I might stay dry 30 years. But if I try to do it that way, I'll have no healing of what's really wrong. That disordered ego, that inability to be comfortable inside myself, letting how I feel be the most important thing in the universe. The only relief I ever get from that is through those steps. And furthermore, if I try to do it that way, I may be a member of the fellowship, but I'm not even in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Unless I'm somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9 the way this book says, in order to reach a state of recovery, or having done that, I'm doing the action a day at a time, that is steps 10, 11, and 12. You know, I have trouble reading the big book, and I tell you why I have trouble. I already know what it says. If you already know what something says, there are passages that are part of my morning meditation. Most mornings of my life, I read those passages. Well, I glance at them, and my brain records that I know what that said, and I go right on. But every once in a while, God will give me the grace. God's grace lets me actually see what the ink on the paper says. And I got such a gift on that 10th step deal. First 2 or 3 years I was sober, I would have sworn on a stack of Bibles that my daily reprieve from alcoholism was contingent on my spiritual condition. I thought that's what it said. And I knew what the words were. I could have quoted the words. But I thought what it meant was that my daily reprieve was contingent on my spiritual condition. And that's scary for me. Now, a lot of you guys have been sober a long time, I'm sure, have reached a point where your life is never-ending serenity with never a blip. Ain't happened for me. I still wake up sometimes with the brain spinning. I still wake up obsessed on things and afraid of things. There are mornings when I try to pray. I can't remember the last word I just tried to pray. And if I had to, and I feel cut off from AA, I feel cut off from God. If I had to assess my spiritual condition, it'd be El Crapo. And if my daily reprieve were contingent on that, I might get struck drunk that day. But what the book says, thank God, is that my daily reprieve is contingent on maintenance of my spiritual condition. And what that means, just like a car, I've got a car in Louisville, and it's got a condition, and I can't wave a wand and change its condition, but the maintenance of that car is all action, over which I have 100% control. So you see, what it really says is that my daily reprieve isn't contingent on how I am. My daily reprieve is contingent on what I do that day. Is contingent on the action. I've got the key in my pocket every single day. And thank God, that's good, good news. But anyway, they finished up on the steps at that time by telling me that the steps were the prescription for alcoholism, that they worked on alcoholism like penicillin works on an infection, They explained that if I had an infection that was going to kill me but would respond to antibiotics, I didn't need to understand my infection. I didn't need to worry my friend's death about where I got it and the nature of it. I didn't need to understand one single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. Didn't even need to believe that that bottle of pills could take care of all these terrible things wrong with wonderful me. And the real kicker was I didn't even need to want to take the pills. If I've got the infection and I take the pills as directed, I'll get just fine, thank you. And they explained to me these steps work on alcoholism the same way. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning, every night, and ask and thank a power greater than myself. And the tears came to my eyes and said, man, I can't do that. I've been trying for 2.5 years to change myself inside so that I think, feel, and believe more like you guys, and I can't change anything. So the second step's what's killing me. And I finally was given ears to hear them when they said for probably the 1,000th time, Don, you got that backwards too. We have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. And like I told you earlier, without divine intervention, I think it's all about what I think, feel, and believe. That's what we got to work on, get changed so as I can do right. They said, why no? Said, Don, we would never suggest that you think, feel, or believe anything, son. They said, in the first place, you are far too ill to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs whatsoever. They said, in the second place, your thoughts, feelings, beliefs are your illness. They're one and the same. It's not even any overlap. They said, in the third place, the issue, whether you live or die, will be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, or believe won't have one thing to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, get down on those knees and start saying those words, and don't worry about what's going through your head because it won't count. And by the grace of God, not knowing why, sometime in April of 81, over my brain's loud veto, I started getting on my knees every morning, every night, and 100% acting as if. And the miracle of the second step began to happen. All I had to do with the second step was be willing to act like a person would have acted if they had been willing to believe there was a power greater than themselves that could solve their problems. If as long as I kept it that I had to actually believe that in my heart, I was never going to do it. I was going to go to that pauper's grave. It wasn't until I realized that the second step, too, for me was action rather than a change of heart or a change of mind. They led me through the third step in Nashville. Oh, by the way, on to praying. As far as I know, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees since April of 81, but I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. My entire deal, guys, has been progress and not perfection. Right today, I stumble and stumble. Sometimes I have to start over 50 or 100 times a day. The reason I'm talking about not having missed a morning and all those thousands of mornings of nights is this. At least half the time, I hadn't really wanted to get down there. There have been a bunch of times when I could have gotten a written doctor's excuse that I didn't feel like getting down there. A whole lot of times I could have gotten stacks of affidavits from lawyers and judges that I didn't have time to get down there. Been a bunch of mornings when the old brain was spinning and I was feeling cut off and I was scared and obsessed that it seemed like I couldn't remember the last word I just tried to pray. The words clearly were bouncing off the walls and ceiling, and it was obvious that it couldn't be doing any good. But I've gotten down there every morning, every night, and something's worked every single day. And it's the only way I know how to stay sober. I have no experience in staying sober without getting on my knees every morning and every night. They led me through the third step. And by the way, I lived in Nashville sober for 21 months, unemployed, unemployable. By the time I celebrated a year sober, I was living in an attic with no phone, no car, no job, teeth finishing rotting out of my head, happier than I'd ever been in my life. They led me through the third step, finally got it through my head. The third step doesn't happen to you. It's an action step. You've either done it or you hadn't. Got it through my head. It doesn't turn a thing over to God. It's merely making that formal decision to do the rest of the steps and then the next right thing instead of what I want to do, which is what turns my life and will over to God. Then they led me through the fourth and fifth step, and I did that, formed a picture of what a spiritual Don ought to look like. Blew past step 6 and 7, thought that was where, with God's help, I went to work on me to make me into what I'd decided a spiritual Don ought to be. In the process of doing steps 8 and 9, as a pure byproduct, by God incidents, my law license got put back in order. I didn't think I'd ever get a law license back, didn't want one back, and didn't think it was in the realm of possibility. If I'd made a list on the day that I was a year sober, if I made a list of the 100 things I was most likely to do for a living the rest of my life, Social Security disability for the brain damage would have been top, but and seriously, it would have been. And practicing law would not have been on that list of 100 things, but it got put back in order. In January of 83, I went back to Louisville scared to death because I couldn't find a minimum wage job in Nashville. If I actually gotten a job in a convenience store in Nashville, I would never have gone back to Louisville to practice law. And I want to tell you, looking back on the reasons I didn't want to go back to Louisville when I was a little less than 2 years sober, it wasn't paranoia. They still look like pretty darn good reasons to me today. But God left me the choice. I could either go back or starve to death. So I knew Louisville AA was dangerous for me. I knew it wouldn't work nearly as well as Nashville. But I went back and I threw myself into that dumb old Louisville AA, and it wasn't a month before I thought it might be better than Nashville. And the second month I was back in town, by God incidents, I wound up talking in front of the Kentucky State Convention, 2,000 people. And people started saying nice things to me. Don, will you talk here? Will you be my sponsor? Will you do that? I've always sponsored an awful lot of guys, and I've always gone to 4 or 5 meetings a week. I've always tried to do what I was asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. That same month, I saw my daughter Dana for the first time in over 3 years, and 2 months later, Dana moved in with me, and she lived with me all during her high school years, and she's been in Al-Anon over 20 years, got a couple of little babies, and just doing great. I talked to her yesterday, and she and I talk about 12-stepping people and God and that sort of thing, and can get under one another's nerves to the point where make the other break out in hives. So I don't want to paint any saccharine, unrealistic picture here, but it sure is better, a million times better than no relationship, and it is a dear, good friendship. First 9 years of my sobriety were really great. They were enchanted. All those wonderful things were happening. I started making a little money right away when I got back. And first thing you know, I'm driving a decent car and wearing nice clothes and people saying these wonderful things to me. And I became a circuit speaker real early on. And by the time I was 9 years sober, I was sponsoring between 40 and 50 people. I'm talking all over the country and I'm down inside. Relationships with opposite sex and financial chaos are killing me. They have beaten me to death. Now I don't want to knock psychology, and I don't knock psychology, but I just stick with the big book. But I've heard that you stop maturing emotionally when you start drinking alcoholically, and that might be a good deal, because I was about 13 when I got sober, and some woman that looked good enough that she'd have had difficulty getting a job honing a house could pay a little attention to me, and I would have passed any lie detector test on earth when I tearfully professed undying love. Of course, week to 2 weeks later, I'd wake up and think, if I don't get away from him, I'm going to die. And if I don't get away from him right now, I'm going to die. And you keep doing that over and over, and it's really hard to reconcile with spiritual gianthood. You know, it really, really creates a lot of conflicts. And with the financial chaos, the more money I made, the worse the financial chaos got. And something happened. I'm going to wind up here, so I'm not going to give you the details. But something happened in May of 1990 when I was sober 9 years that caused me to look at step 6 and 7 again. And I began to realize, and words are so important to me in sobriety. For instance, the word realize. I always thought to know something and to realize it were the same thing, but realize is a form of the word real. When I have realized something, that literally means it has become real inside me. There's stuff I've known for 30 years that I have not realized. And I knew the seventh-step prayer well enough, I could have quoted it to you backwards. If you'd given me 3 or 4 minutes to sit down at a table with me, I'd have started at the last word and gone back to the first word quoting it. But I thought that prayer meant that God was supposed to move all the defects of character that were inconsistent with my picture of what a spiritual Don ought to be. And I certainly thought that it involved God removing all the defects of character that were making my self-centered butt uncomfortable. You see, for those 9 years, whatever character defect was making me uncomfortable and embarrassing me, I'd use steps, sponsors, meetings, outside counseling, inventories. I'd grab it by the collar and slam it up against the wall and say, come here, God, give me a little help, and we'll get rid of this thing. And God never showed up, and I didn't know what was wrong. But when I began to look at it again, I began to realize that prayer means what it says. It doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. It asks God to remove the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows, and I don't know which ones they are. You see, I know now that my usefulness today is largely built on those character defects that have persisted so long in my sobriety that I struggled so much with, but I managed not to drink and kept stumbling in the right direction. I got some relief, and that's mainly what I've got to share with you guys this morning. I couldn't see that. It looked all negative to me, and I began to understand that my problem with perfection isn't what I thought it was. I thought it was my inability to attain perfection, and certainly I am unable to attain it, but that's never mattered. I never get that far. I can't recognize perfection. If God gave me the power to become anything or anybody I thought I ought to be this morning, I'd be like a blind dog in a butcher shop. I'd have no idea who and what I ought to be. It turned out that step 6 and 7 was truly for me where I went back to my God again, as I did in the third step. Would have went back and said, God, I understand that I can't figure out the patterns of my life. See, without divine intervention, everything in my life, the way I want to approach it is let me figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. Problem. I'm 64 years old and hadn't figured out a single pattern right yet. Now, why I still want to waste 40% of my time doing that, I don't know. But I've got less chance of figuring out the patterns of my life than a chimpanzee does mastering quantum physics. It's just beyond me. My job is stitching. And there's a little spark of the divine in me that if I listen to it, and the enemy of taking that stitch in the right place, that I know in my heart not to tell this lie, not to do this selfish thing, but do this thing that's better for somebody else, the enemy is not usually fear and greed and greed and lust, which I thought it would be. That's about 1% of the time. It's fear. It's fear. It's fear that I won't get something I want, I'll lose something I don't want to lose, or the very worst of all for most of us, I'll look bad. I think most of us are really more afraid of looking bad than we are dying, if we want to get real honest about it. And it turned out that for the last 18 years, 18 and a half years now, I've been stumbling in that direction. And by the way, again, I'm not knocking psychology in any way. Page 133 tells me God filled this world with wonderful doctors and counselors, and it did. I'm just saying that if we try to take alcoholism to those poor people, it's a lot like taking a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. There's just nothing in there. Even if one of us had ever told them the truth, they probably couldn't do any good. It's just another easier, softer way rather than trying to take it to these 12 steps. But I don't want any issues in my life. Please deliver me from issues. Here's the reason why. I must have heard in 27 years about 20,000 issues enunciated. I have never heard one that didn't fall into one of the three parts of the fourth step. It involves resentment, fear, sexuality, or some combination of those things. But the real reason I don't want one is of those 20,000 I've heard about, I'm not aware of a single one that is permanently and satisfactorily resolved. So I don't want issues. I want character defects. I know what to do with character defect. I don't know what to do with an issue. So the last 18 and a half years, I've been stumbling that way. And, guys, I got to tell you, the forgiveness of non-alcoholics for us when we try to do the right thing passes all understanding. I'm just going to take a minute and tell you some of the things that have happened. I used to not do this, but some guys in Louisville that in the program, sponsors of mine, set me down and said, Don, you have to talk about this. The reason I don't want to talk about it is I've always been afraid that it sounds like in some way I'm bragging. For years, I've had a line of young lawyers that reach all the way back to that wall that want to practice a case with me, not for money and not because I'm so smart. It's because on the good days I can go down there and I, instead of trying to make money, win cases, look good, cover my butt, outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver, on the good days I can go down there and just try to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. On the good days I know that the quiet loving truth is so loud in or out of a courtroom that nobody can hear anything else. The sound of the quiet loving truth is just so loud. That bar association that kicked me out so loudly and that I disgraced so badly and so publicly has honored me until it's embarrassing. For years I was on a committee that interviewed people that wanted to be judges and pass on whether they were qualified. I was chair of that committee. then made me master it in a court where I sat there with Supreme Court, State Supreme Court justices, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals people, and one little drunken criminal defense lawyer. They put me on, they made me the pro bono lawyer of the year in 2003. And believe me, the first 10 years I practiced law, nobody mentioned Don Major and pro bono in the same breath. But probably God's greatest sense of humor is that between 3 and 4 years ago, I was sitting in the barber chair and my cell phone rang. And believe me, God does have a sense of humor. It was the president of the state bar, and he said, "Don, we have got a vacancy on the ethics committee." The first 10 years I practiced law, the only people in the world I was more afraid of than the State Bar Ethics Committee were the IRS and the FBI, I assure you. I will have been married to Sharon 18 years come December, and Sharon and I don't argue. I sponsor some guys that are psychologists and some that are counselors, and they tell me it's not healthy to have a relationship where you never argue. And I tell them that I'm just going to wallow in my illness, that they are welcome to their healthy relationships, that I'm doing just fine with that, thank you. And here's the bottom line. If in May of 1990, that 6- and 7-step thing and realizing what it really is, it's just so simple that it's almost impossible to get. Stumbling that way for 18 and a half years, if I had made a list of everything that I thought was the best I could have in every area of my life, material, professional, personal, spiritual, every way, and God had looked at that list and said, "Don, I'm sick of your whining. I'm going to give you exactly what you have asked for," I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm willing to let go of my little ideas of what I ought to be, and try to just come like a little child and take that next stitch and leave it up to my God. My God has got things in store for me that are more beautiful than anything I could imagine. Thank you all. I love you all, and keep coming back.